Welcome to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and this morning I'm delighted to be in conversation with an author whose books many Aldis will have hugely enjoyed. A prolific writer, Alexander McCall Smith is best known for his number one Ladies Detective Agency series set in Botswana. The first of those novels was published in 1998, and by 2009, the series had sold 20 million copies. The series has been translated into 46 languages and sold the world over, making its rooibos tea-sipping heroine, Mama Precious Ramotswe, a household name amongst fans of the books. Alexander Orsandi was appointed a CBE in the 2007 New Year's Honours List for services to literature, and in 2024 was knighted for services to literature, academia and charity. Sandy McCall Smith, a very warm welcome to Radio Aldi.
Thank you very much indeed, Charlotte.
Now, before we get on to your upbringing in what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, can we start by talking about the prodigious rate at which you write? Because aside from the number one Ladies Detective Agency, you've written countless books, far too many to list here. Even before you embarked on the number one Ladies Detective Agency, you'd written over 30 books while engaged in a full-time career as an academic. How fast do you actually write? And when did you first realise that you could do that?
Well, I must say I'm very fortunate and I'm very conscious of my good fortune in this respect, in that I do find that I can write quite quickly. I think Flaubert wrote something like 35 words an hour or something like that. It was not particularly, or it might have been 35 words a day. It wasn't a very high rate.
No.
I write about 1,000 words an hour when I'm in my stride. It's an interesting thing. I don't have to sit at the computer on which I write and say to myself, what's going to happen now? It just comes. Maybe I shouldn't talk about it in case Nemesis's radar picks it up. She's always listening to these programs. I'm sure she listens to the Aldi regularly. But I think it's a question of practicing, getting in touch with that part of the mind, the imagination, whatever, that creates the stories. So it's developing brain pathways, very similar to the pathways, I think, that one develops when one learns to play the piano.
But when did you discover you could do this?
Probably in my 30s, somewhere around about then, early 30s, I discovered that I could write without having to sit there and think too much about it, and that it came out, and that there was very little that I had to do to the prose once it was on the page. However, I had written before that. I think that I'd always seen myself as somebody who would eventually sit down and write something. I sent off my first manuscript when I was 8. It was I think, probably not even a whole page. And the publisher wrote a very nice letter back saying, we can't publish this, but carry on writing. What a lovely thing to do to an 8-year-old child.
And what was the first thing that you published ever?
Probably the first thing that I ever had published was a little essay on Alfred Nobel and dynamite. I entered it into a competition when I was a schoolboy of 15 or 16, I think. Mm. And I was fortunate enough to win, and it was published in the local newspaper.
Hard though this is to believe, some of our listeners might not have read the number one Ladies Detective Agency. So can you just describe its wonderful heroine, Precious Ramotswe, and tell us a bit about who the inspiration for her was?
Well, the number one Ladies Detective Agency is a series of novels set in Botswana. And Precious Ramotswe, Ma Ramotswe, is the heroine of this rather long saga. She is a woman who sets up a little detective agency in Gaborone, the capital of Botswana, after her father has died and left her some cattle. She sells the cattle and sets up this agency. She doesn't have the first clue about running a detective agency. It's designed to help people with their problems. So it's the usual thing, missing partners, badly behaved husbands, the usual thing that these private detective agencies deal with. So she sets it up. She gets a wonderful secretary called Grace Macuzzi, who was distinguished in getting 97% in the final exams of the Botswana Secretarial College, and points that out to us every book several times. And they set up this little business. And Moramotswe really, I suppose, represents a certain sort of woman whom one might meet in Botswana or indeed in many other African societies, very intelligent, intuitive, and with a very friendly approach to life. She's exactly the sort of person you would like to sit down and have a cup of tea with. She's very wise. And I thought initially that I would write a short story about this woman, but I ended up writing a whole book, and then we're on to volume 26 coming up. So a long saga.
But before we go back to your life in Scotland and Africa and everything, I just wanted to touch on one other thing that I was really interested by. You did this award-winning serialised cross-media novel, Corduroy Mansions, in 2008, which was read by Andrew Sachs in audio edition and written on the Daily Telegraph Media Group. Didn't you have to write every day to keep up? And even you said it was like being on a tightrope.
But the first newspaper serial novel that I wrote was the Scotland Street series in The Scotsman. The Daily Telegraph one came much later. That's after I'd already set up the Scotland Street series. So I was at one stage writing two serial novels in two newspapers, the Scotsman newspaper and the Telegraph. I still write the Scotland Street novels in The Scotsman. I do. There's a period at the beginning of the year where I write a chapter a day for about 3 months. And then the book, then it comes out as a book. I believe it's the world's longest running proper serial novel appearing in the papers. Because the serial novel is a great institution, a long-standing institution. It's the way that Charles Dickens and others used it. Then it sort of disappeared until Armistead Maupin wrote Tales of the City in the San Francisco Chronicle. And indeed, it was a conversation that I had with Armistead Maupin when I was on tour and I was in San Francisco. I was at a party that was held by Amy Tan, the novelist, and I found myself talking to Armistead Maupin, and he said, "Whatever you do, don't write a serial novel." And I came back to Scotland and did just that. And I love doing it. Scotland Street still goes. I think I'm on volume 18 of the Scotland Street series. And the characters there have become, I'm happy to say, quite popular. There's a little boy called Bertie who's much put upon by his rather pushy mother. Corduroy Mansions, I really enjoyed writing. I did three books in that series. That was set in London, but went around. So they characters. One of the characters lived in Cheltenham and so on. In each of those series, interestingly enough, one of the most popular characters is a dog. In Scotland Street, we've got Cyril, who's a sort of border collie, who's the only dog in Scotland to have a gold tooth. And he's got a big... Yeah, people love him. He's got a big following. And in Corduroy Mansions, I had a dog called Freddie de la Haye, who lived in Pimlico. And Freddie's owner was a wine dealer who lived in Pimlico. And he became very popular. Freddie had a very bad start in life. He'd been a sniffer dog at Heathrow Airport. But he was the victim of a sort of political correctness campaign when they discovered that all the sniffer dogs at the airport were male dogs. And so they fired half of them. and appointed female dogs in their place. Bad mistake, because the male dogs thereafter were only interested in the female dogs, and the drugs the drugs flooded into the country. And Freddie Lillehei was a very popular character. He was I invented a breed for him. He was a Pimlico Terrier. And I had some people wrote to me and said, you know, where could they get a Pimlico Terrier? They rather liked the idea of a Pimlico Terrier.
Let's get on to your upbringing now. You were born in 1948 in Bulawayo to British parents, in what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, of course, an only son with three older sisters. Bulawayo, I've been to Bulawayo. It's so beautiful with the frangipani blossom everywhere.
It was a very, very beautiful city and still is. Mm. I'm very much out of touch with Zimbabwe and with Bulawayo, because I spent my childhood there and then the rest of my life in mainly in Scotland, almost entirely in Scotland, although I lived in Belfast for a year, and I've spent periods of time elsewhere, including Botswana and Swaziland. So Bulawayo was a very attractive city, beautiful setting. And it was an unusual childhood, but I think when you come to think of it, just about everybody's childhood is a bit unusual. And then I came to university in Edinburgh. I did my undergraduate degree at Edinburgh University, and then went on to do a postgraduate degree in Edinburgh. I studied law. And I became an academic lawyer. I taught in universities, a number of universities. My main career was at the University of Edinburgh, where I ended up as the professor of medical law. And then during that time, in my spare time, I had this other existence as a writer. But when the Number One Ladies Detective Agency took off, particularly in the United States, I had to make a decision about which way things were going to go. And so I took an unpaid leave of absence from my chair at the university and said that I'd go away for 3 years and that I hoped that I would return. But in fact, it was impossible to return.
What took you to law in the first place?
Law is a very interesting discipline. It's it has, I suppose, something for everybody, and rather like medicine. Medicine's another career where people can find their niche, which suits their particular interests. The law is all about human affairs. I'm very interested in human action in the way we act and behave, and in issues around that, and also. I ended up specialising in the relationship between law and medicine, which, of course, is a very interesting one where all sorts of ethical issues arise in relation to medical and scientific progress generally. Mm. These issues are constantly coming up, and they're often very, very complex issues. And sometimes feeling runs very high around them.
I found another really interesting fact out about you, which I loved this bit, that you play the bassoon and you started the really terrible orchestra.
I used to play the bassoon. Uh-huh. I've taken to playing the baritone sax a bit more. I like wind instruments. I took lessons in quite a lot of wind instruments. I suppose the first one wind instrument I learned as an adult was the saxophone, and I still play that very, very badly. And then I went to the reed instrument, double reed instruments, and I learnt the bassoon, which I enjoyed. And then my wife and I decided that we had our children were participating in school orchestras, and that neither she nor I had been in a school orchestra. And we felt that we'd missed out. So we decided to form an orchestra for people who wanted to be in an amateur orchestra, but who weren't really very good. In fact, probably were rather bad. And so we decided to do this, and it was over 20 years ago. we set up something called the Really Terrible Orchestra in Edinburgh. And the name would reassure people that they would be able to get in. So the Really Terrible Orchestra, or the RTO, as it's fondly known, started off, and we were overwhelmed by people who wanted to join it. And some of them were reasonably competent with their instruments, but the majority weren't. And believe it or not, we decided to start going on tour. And we went, our first tour was to a little village in Fife, a little fishing village called Pitten Weem, where we appeared at the Fisherman's Institute, a sellout concert. And I think the reason why it was sellout was, firstly, the tickets were free, and secondly, the poster said free wine. And so the population turned up for that first concert. And we were then emboldened. We said to ourselves, why don't we go to New York? And so we went to New York, believe it or not, and we played at the New York City Hall, which we almost filled. There were about 100 seats unfilled, but we had 1,300 people of capacity of 1,400 at the New York Town Hall. It was absolutely amazing. And we played really badly, and the New York audience absolutely loved it, because they saw, here was this group of rank amateurs trying to struggle through the pieces, trying to reach the end at the same time, if at all possible. And we had a standing ovation at the end.
For effort.
Yes. And the RTO, the Royal Chamber Orchestra, still exists. We do an annual concert at the on the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, and we get 600 people coming to our concert, some of whom are not actually related to us, nor close friends.
Apparently you then went on and helped found the number one ladies' opera house in Botswana.
Well, we set up a little, what we were rather grandly and pretentiously called Number One Ladies' Opera House. It was a lovely little building, which had been a garage workshop back in the day. It was in the bush just outside Gaborone, the capital. And I took a lease of this building, a five-year lease of this building, and set up a tiny little opera house with 50 seats.
Gosh!
Yeah, it was just charming. Great friend of mine, who was a great producer and director and actor, Nicholas Ellenbogen, he came up from Cape Town and built, he was also a very good carpenter, he built the seats and the stage in this little theatre. And there was a nice little restaurant attached to it. And we opened with an opera, a chamber opera, for which I wrote the libretto. But the music was written by my great late friend, Tom Cunningham, who was a marvellous choral composer.
Wasn't it Macbeth set in a community of baboons that you wrote?
It was called the Okavango Macbeth. And there was an interesting story attached to that, in that I'd been in the Okavango Delta in northern Botswana, and we were on the river there with our wonderful guide, a lovely man called Mighty, with whom I'm still in touch. And Mighty, as we were going through on the boat in the Okavango River, I saw some huts on the side bank under these towering trees. And I said, Mighty, what's that over there? And he said, oh, that's the baboon people. They live with baboons. And I realized who this was. And I take an interest in reading in an amateur way. Works of primatology, and I'd read a book recently called Baboon Metaphysics, which was all about to what extent baboons have the concept of the other mind. And I realized this camp of American primatologists who'd lived with this troop of baboons for years.
Oh, how fascinating.
Yeah. And so we went ashore. As we crossed the river in this boat, I cupped my hands and shouted out to the other shore, I've just read Baboon Metaphysics. And people came racing out of the huts to welcome us. And this was this husband and wife team who'd lived there with the baboons. And they talked to me about this, and they explained how female baboons can be ambitious for their male partner.
Oh, Lady Macbeth.
Lady Macbeth. And so I went back to Scotland and said, Tom, you know, we've been meaning to write an opera. Oh, yes. And I said, let's do an opera set in Botswana amongst a troop of baboons based on the Lady Macbeth story. And he looked at me as if I just had a serious case of sunstroke. And but he wrote the most beautiful music for it. It's a lovely, it's a very, very tuneful opera. And we opened, its very first performance was in the Number One Ladies Opera House. We ran it for a week there. We used local young people, only two of whom had ever had any voice training. And they did this, it was just so lovely. It was so moving. And one of the young people came, these young singers, came up to me afterwards and he said, this is the best thing that's happened to me in my life.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, well, that made the whole thing worthwhile. It really was lovely. And then after a number of years, well, the lease came up for renewal. It was going to be much more difficult to keep it going, so with some regret we let it close. But it was a lovely, lovely episode.
And has the baboon Macbeth or the Okavango Macbeth been performed ever again?
Yes, it's had a number of performances.
Oh, marvellous.
It was there was a production. It was performed in Cambridge in aid of Addenbrooke's Hospital, I think.
Oh, marvellous.
And then it was done several week-long seasons in Edinburgh, one on the Edinburgh Fringe and another not as part of the Fringe programme. So it's had a number. And there's an opera house looking at it at the moment, and it would be wonderful if it had further performances. It's a gorgeous piece of music. You can see it on YouTube. You go to YouTube and you put in Okavango Macbeth, you'll see rather nice excerpts of it.
Well, I hope you keep that updated because I'm sure oldies will want to go and see the next performance. It sounds great. There's just one other thing to touch on with you. You're a great conservationist. Tell us about the cairns of Cull.
Well, I wouldn't describe myself as great conservationist. I share the general concern that most of us have about conserving the world. There's a small group of islands north of Cull, beautiful little islands, the largest of which is 50 acres. They're uninhabited. And they came on the market, and I was concerned that nothing should happen. I didn't want anything to happen to them, because occasionally, I've like so many other people in this area, I've been out there on my boat, and they've got beautiful beaches and lagoons, and the only structure on them is a lighthouse, a working Stevenson lighthouse. And I thought it would be a good idea to try and preserve these for people to enjoy. And I've had a conversation with my daughters about how, when I'm no longer around, they should just keep these as they are. People go out, whale watching boats go out and sometimes stop for a picnic and things like that. So, lots of seabirds.
And seals.
Lots of seals.
Oh, lovely.
It's a blessed spot.
Now, before I let you go, can you just tell us about your latest novel, The Lost Language of Oysters, which is the latest in the Professor von, how do you pronounce him?
Eaglefelt.
Yeah. Tell us about him and what the latest one's about.
Well, this is volume 6 in the Portuguese Irregular Verbs series. Those are really, really peculiar books about a German philologist, professor of language, of linguistics, called Moritz Maria von Eaglefelt and his friends, Professor Dr. Detlef Amadeus Unterholzer and Professor Dr. Florianus Prinzl. And these three academics spent a lot of their time arguing with one another. Von Eaglefelt is rather I rather like him, but he's a bit of a lost soul. He wrote a famous book called Portuguese Irregular Verbs, And he's very miffed that not enough people are reading this great tome of scholarship. And the books really are about all the humiliations that poor von Eagleveldt has in life. In the latest one, The Lost Language of Oysters, he's visited in his institute in Regensburg by two lady professors of linguistics from New Orleans, Professor Pompom Boisseau and Professor Alice Martinique, and they arrive on their motorcycles. And so there are many misunderstandings ahead.
So where on earth did he come from and how did he pop into your imagination?
Professor von Eagleveldt arose as a result of my friendship with Professor Dr. Reinhard Zimmermann of the University of Regensburg at that stage.
Uh-huh.
And he's the godfather of our younger daughter. And I had dealings with him and with other German professors in the course of my academic career. And the German academic world can be quite formal, and the professors can be immensely privileged. They're probably the most privileged professoriate in the world. And so I decided to have a little bit of fun with these people. It's done in good I hope in good spirits and taken in good spirits. That's how he arose. And so I initially wrote a short story about how these three professors went to a hotel in Zurich for a conference and saw a tennis court and decided that they'd try and play tennis, although none of them could play tennis. But they found a book. They found a book called The Principles of Tennis by Captain Geoffrey Pembleton, sometime tennis champion of Cambridge University. And so they look at the book and they try to play tennis according to the book. And of course, the book was written before the end of the tiebreaker. So the game can't end because none of them ever gets a ball over the net. And I so liked the characters that I made that story into a full length book called Portuguese Irregular Verbs. And then we had the finer points of Sausage Dogs, the Villa of Reduced Circumstances, Unusual Uses for Olive Oil. The last one before this new one was called Your Inner Hedgehog. And now we have. So you get the general idea.
Yes. And what are you writing right now?
I have just finished a new novel, which will be published a little bit later this year, called The Private Side of Friendship, which is set in Edinburgh in 1984. I am writing the next Isabel Dalhousie novel. That's another series set in Edinburgh about a moral philosopher called Isabel Dalhousie. I'm writing that. I'm writing a screenplay, and I'm putting together my third collection of poetry.
Incredible. What an absolute privilege to talk to you, Sandy McCall-Smith. Thank you very, very much for coming on Radio Aldi with me.
Charlotte, I've enjoyed our conversation so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Alexander McCall-Smith on Radio Aldi. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldi.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to my guest, Alexander McCall-Smith, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get three trial issues of the Aldi magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every six issues. Just go to checkout.theoldi.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldi.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.